You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, funeral home prices can vary by thousands of dollars for the same services. We'll hear about an NPR investigation into the death care industry and how to navigate a confusing process.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The big story this week was Governor Walker's budget plan. We'll check out a couple of proposals that haven't gotten the most attention. Also, we take a look at the group that manages high school athletics in the state and a controversy surrounding a Wisconsin congressional representative.
Robert Mentzer is with us. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins us every Friday. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with the state budget. Lots of news coming out of that. You pointed out one item that hasn't gotten as much attention as some of the high-profile stuff, youth mental health care. What do we see in this budget?
Sure. So Governor Scott Walker would add $6 million to the state budget that would really be targeted at addressing some specific needs for youth mental health. So it would include $3 million to help school districts hire more social workers, $2.5 million in grants to help school districts connect kids to outside mental health services if they're needed, and another $1 million to provide training for school district staff to make sure that they're able to screen for mental health challenges, know how to intervene when an intervention is needed. This is something that our reporter Rory Lenane with USA Today Network Wisconsin looked at this week, because she has been the lead reporter on the Kids in Crisis series that looks specifically at these issues. And you know, some of these proposals seem to be a direct response to some of that reporting. And the advocates that she spoke with this week said that it really is this really would make a difference, and it really is the word was unprecedented level of emphasis to youth mental health coming out of this budget.
And not everything in this budget is going to get bipartisan support, but this is something, as I understand it, that State Superintendent Tony Evers from Public Instruction, he talked about on this show, one of his priorities for the budget, something that Republicans and Democrats might all get behind.
For sure, and you never quite know. This is just the governor's document, and so there's a long way to go before the school districts actually start to have these social work services available. So we wouldn't want to. I don't want to state it too strongly that this is a done deal, but it's not. It doesn't seem to be a controversial proposal. That is true. There is bipartisan support for it. That is true. And I think there's going to be plenty of things to fight about in the budget. And it is worthwhile to step back and look at the ways that budget decisions that legislators make will actually really make a concrete difference in people's lives. This might be an area that that addresses a need. We found that USA Today Network Wisconsin found that staffing for social workers in schools is well below what professional organizations recommend. It's not this really is a need, and this looks like it might be a way of actually addressing that.
And then looking at the bigger picture, tax cuts, part of the governor's budget. What kind of things do we see there?
For sure. So the other thing, there's a lot in the budget, right? So there's substantial increases in funding for K-12 schools. There are $203 million worth of income taxes, a sales tax holiday, and then another $340 million in property tax cuts. There's also there would be 2% raises for state workers in Governor Scott Walker's budget. So this budget certainly, has been remarked. I'm not the first to notice that this budget looks a lot different from Walker's previous budgets. This comes at a time when the economy has been growing. There is more state revenue to work with, and so you see this document is a stark departure from prior budgets, and many think is sort of opening volley in a possible reelection campaign by the governor.
We'll have occasion to talk about these points in future weeks. We're talking to Rob Mentzer.
This might come up. You're right.
Rob Mentzer is with us from the USA Today Network Wisconsin, our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. Let's step away from the budget for a moment. moment, Rob. One of your reporters looked at salary increases at the WIAA. That's the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association. It's a nonprofit that manages a lot of the high school athletics here in the state. What did you find?
Sure, and it is big business there. So our investigative reporter, Keegan Kyle, who is a friend of Central Time, I believe.
He's been on.
He had first done a report. He broke the story last year that the salaries of sort of the top executives at the WIAA had been steadily climbing, and that the revenues of this agency, which is a nonprofit and which is it's supposed to be an educational service. These are high school kids we're talking about in high school, youth athletics. Had been steadily rising, and that they were something like 8% of the organization's total expenses were in salaries for just these handful of positions. So this is sort of a follow up to that report, and in the latest story, Keegan Kyle found that indeed the executives got another raises between sort of 4% and or so 3%, 4% in the last year, even as the WIAA's revenues actually declined last year.
And then WIAA has faced calls for transparency, including from some state lawmakers. Give us a little of the backdrop there.
Right, and this may be even a more significant finding from these financial disclosures that the nonprofit released. So that one of the things that the story reported is that the WIAA last year hired 4 lobbyists and spent more than $27,000 to oppose legislation that would have brought it under the state's open records and open meetings laws. They really do not like that idea. They argue that they're a private nonprofit and the state doesn't open records laws don't apply to a private nonprofit. The argument that the piece of legislation is introduced by one of the Republican leaders, Representative John Nygren, and his argument is that they're engaged with mostly public schools. Are the majority of their revenue comes from working with public schools, and these are public events, and these are supposed to be educational events. And so he has argued and has introduced a bill that would open them up and require more disclosures than what we get now. That bill hasn't gone anywhere in the past. The latest that we know is Nygren plans to introduce it again. So maybe he'll have better luck, or maybe that debate will continue.
Finally, a story related to your neck of the woods there. Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy in the news after an exchange over terrorism on a CNN talk show with Allison Camerota. She was asking, here's a listen, she's asking why there wasn't more focus on white nationalist terrorists after the recent mosque attack up in Canada.
Are you going to compare the one attack up in Canada to all the death and destruction in Europe from refugees?
How about
the attacks in the United States of America?
He was a white extremist.
Yeah, he was. Okay.
How about that? That doesn't matter?
No, it does matter. It does matter. Look at the good things that came from it. And Nikki Haley took down the Confederate flag. That was great. Mm-hmm. But you want to say, I can give you a couple examples. Mm-hmm. There's no constant thread that goes through these attacks.
A lot of attention to this, Rob. What are some of the reactions you've seen?
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of a cable news controversy, which I guess in one sense is something that happens every day. But this is blown up into a large scale controversy, and I think that you could hear it in the clip. Representative Sean Duffy was engaged in a sort of debate on cable news, and in the course of it, he did seem to downplay the importance of the Dylann Roof white supremacist attack in Charleston, and also this is a discussion of white extremism and terrorist acts by right wing groups or right wing members. They did not talk about the 2012 attack in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, when a white supremacist terrorist shot and killed six people at a Sikh temple there. And so, you know, I think that the way that it came off, or the way it's been perceived, is that he was downplaying what is recognized by law enforcement and by many who study these things as what is a serious threat to American safety, which is, you know, it comes from white right-wing extremists. Duffy has, to some extent, tried to explain his viewpoint that he's hit in radio interviews is that the difference that he was referring to is that, you know, they were talking in the context of President Trump's travel ban executive order, and the difference is that any white extremists are already in the United States, they're already in the country, whereas the president's policy was aimed at keeping people out. So that is one explanation, but I think that it just seemed a little glib, and it just seemed to downplay the importance of some of the horrific attacks we have seen.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joined us for our weekly look at the top news stories from around the state.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Walker called for a reorganization at the state's Department of Natural Resources in his new state budget, but he did not advance a plan to completely split up that agency. We'll hear more about that and other budget changes that might come to the DNR.
First, NPR's investigative unit has been looking into the pricing of services at funeral homes across the country, and what they found is a very confusing system that's difficult for grieving customers to make sense of.
NPR released its findings this week, disclosing how prices can vary widely for similar or even identical services by up to thousands of dollars. And funeral home websites do little to reveal what it costs for a funeral, despite a federal rule that requires clear pricing disclosures.
Robert Benincasa has been investigating the death care industry. He's a computer-assisted reporting producer in NPR's investigations unit. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Kate. How are you?
Good. Well, let's start out with getting a sense of how big our country's funeral home business industry is. I'm assuming this is a recession-proof, healthy industry because death happens.
Sure. Not recession-proof. Industry has ebbed and flowed a little bit with the larger economy. In 2012, it was $13 billion in sales. About 15,000 funeral homes around the country. That's not counting cemeteries and some other facilities. So that if you do the math, that works out to about $5,000 per death. If you consider that there are 2.6 million deaths a year in the United States.
And you found funeral homes to be less than transparent for consumers who are trying to navigate all these services that go into a funeral during a very emotional time. What did you find out there in terms of pricing?
Well, the one overriding thing that seemed, you know, consistent throughout the industry is that the pricing is not disclosed in the way that most of us have come to get information, you know, which is through our laptops and our mobile devices. You know, we go online and you can almost anything you buy, you can figure out how much you're going to spend for it. But the funeral establishments, they put up websites, but they don't generally they don't put their price lists up there. So you don't know unless you visit them, you're going to get the best information. They're supposed to give you a written list. And you don't necessarily know what to ask because for most people, they've never done it before. They only do this maybe once or twice in their life and make this purchase.
And the federal government tries to protect people through the funeral rule. Can you explain how this works, this rule works?
Yeah, the funeral rule, you know, it evolved back from the 1970s when the Federal Trade Commission decided that the industry was rife with deceptive business practices. And part of that was the fact that they would lump everything together and say, here's your bill, this is how much it's going to cost you, and consumers couldn't really figure out what those individual things that they were buying cost on a kind of disaggregated basis. So the funeral rule was passed after the government fought with the industry for 10 years. And in 1984, this rule was passed that said, here are 16 things that every funeral home has to name a price for. And they call that the general price list. So if you walk into a funeral home, they're required under this rule to give you that list as soon as you start talking to them. And they have to give you one that you can take with you and keep. And it's got these 16 items on it. But there's other things that they can put on there, you know, package deals and such. But there are 16 standard items that appear on this list that they're required to give you.
Well, when I looked at the information on your story, the Federal Trade Commission's compliance brochure for the funeral rule, I was hoping to even see a mock general price list because, you know, I have no clue how much a fee for embalming may be, not even a ballpark. You know, but there was nothing there to even give you a normal range. So not even the keepers right. of the rule are protecting consumers or helping them set fair market costs.
No, the government isn't in the business of setting prices. And, you know, the prices vary considerably even in the same community. And this is part of the issue. This is part of why it's so hard for consumers to know what's a good price, right? Like, mm-hmm. as you're saying, what is a good price for a cremation, right? It's almost impossible to tell.
We're talking with Robert Benincasa. He is with NPR's Investigations Unit, which has spent several months looking at funeral home prices across the country and finding wide ranges for services. Robert, why don't funeral businesses just post their pricing online? Why is there this issue with showing how much things cost? For example, perhaps a casket, how much a casket costs?
Well, you know, I've asked them this question. The response that I typically get is that a couple things. It's not in their interest competitively, they believe, because their competitors would know their prices and try to undercut them. Although, I don't know, I have a little bit of trouble believing that they don't know what their competitors charge. The other thing is they believe that the information isn't necessarily comprehensible or to consumers. It lacks the context of a personal consultation. You know, I mean, it sounds a little condescending, right? So That's the response I generally get. I also found a distrust of technology in general of a lot of funeral directors. Some of them didn't want to use email to communicate with them, with me. Some of them, if they sent me a price list at all, wanted to do it over the fax. So it's kind of it was kind of a learning experience.
What is the Federal Trade Commission's Funeral Rule Offenders Program?
So about once a year, the Federal Trade Commission sends undercover shoppers into funeral homes, people posing as consumers, but they're actually Federal Trade Commission employees. And they do maybe 100 to 150 at a time. And they go in there and they watch for this compliance. Does the funeral director or the salesperson give them that list that's required under the law? And if you average it out over the past couple of years, it's about one in four does not do that. So at that point, the Federal Trade Commission can either sue them, take them to court in a civil matter, or they could offer them to participate in this offenders program. The funeral home will pay a fine and they will agree to some training about the funeral rule.
And does Wisconsin funeral homes, are they in this program?
I checked and there were four of them from 2013 that entered the program.
What should you do if you see a funeral home you're considering or have used in this program who have been a violator in the past?
Well, I mean, I can't really say what a consumer, I can't provide that kind of advice. If it were me, I mean, I might talk to them about it. You know, one way of looking at it is they might be, you know, more transparent because they've been, you know, they've been reprimanded in a sense, and they've had a bad experience of having to pay a fine. Another way of looking at it is, hey, they were dishonest before. They might be dishonest with me in some way again. You know, a personal decision.
And if you're planning a loved one's funeral, couldn't you offer some advice for this consumer who is trying to navigate the system?
Yeah. I mean, if it's possible to plan it separated from your grief, you know, to do it in advance, that might be a good way to go, especially if you could talk to the person about it, your loved one about it. If that's not possible, take someone with you who isn't as emotionally distraught as you might be, who might see things a little bit more objectively and might be able to help you evaluate those things. If you're inclined to shop around for price, try to do it on the phone, but do it with that list of the items that the government requires. And that should be, you know, out there. On we put a link out there of how to get that. So do it that way and ask those very specific questions. And they're required to give you those prices on the phone.
One thing you also said was to not disclose how much money you might have to spend on this.
Yeah, I wouldn't. You know, I mean, I think you might get, if you disclose that you have $10,000 in life insurance proceeds coming to you, you might get a sales pitch for a $9,000 funeral. And I, you know, I've seen a little bit of evidence of that, that the folks in the industry, some of them, not all of them, of course, want to sell you whatever your budget will bear.
Robert, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Sure, my pleasure.
That was Robert Benincasa. He's a reporter with NPR's Investigations Unit. He's been looking into the pricing of services at funeral homes across the country.
Coming up, we'll look at the future of the DNR and the kind of changes it might see under Governor Walker's proposed state budget. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up tonight after 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, the drama in the Senate over the Betsy DeVos nomination and a vice president standing by in case of a tie. That was exactly the plot of the 1962 movie Advise and Consent. Playwright Murray Horowitz discusses the film and helps draw parallels to what's happening in the current Senate. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, Governor Walker released his 2-year state budget on Wednesday, which looks at everything from voucher schools to tax credits. He also touched on the future of the Department of Natural Resources, a state agency that's seen a shrinking budget and job cuts for scientists and other positions.
Some were concerned that Walker would push for breaking up the DNR, but in his budget, he called for reorganizing the department. The plan has gotten support from Secretary Kathy Stepp and would reduce the number of divisions in the DNR from 7 to 5.
Michael Kraft joins us now. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Public and Environmental Affairs at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Well, the biggest news may be what didn't happen in that budget. This plan circulating, some lawmakers behind it saying, hey, let's break up the DNR, spread out its jobs. The governor said no, or he didn't do that. And some leading lawmakers are saying, well, if he didn't, we're not going to. Is that a pretty significant non-decision?
Well, to the extent the governor is actually saying he's not going to break up the DNR, it would be significant. It wasn't clear until his statement, and I didn't listen to the State of the State speech, so I take your word for it that that's what he said. He did propose in his budget to reduce the divisions in the DNR from 7 to 5 and to have higher park fees because the state no longer funds the state parks, as this was a decision made in the last biennial budget. This plan to break up the DNR has been kicking around for a long time. And it has been strongly opposed by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, by former DNR secretaries, by, of course, a variety of environmental and conservation groups. The support for it seems to come, and I guess there's a parallel on the national level with the EPA and the incoming administrator of that agency, Scott Pruitt. There's a desire to cut back on what people in the business community think of as burdensome regulation and a lot of red tape that slows down development, adds to the cost. And by breaking up the DNR into essentially a Fish and Wildlife Division and an Environmental Protection Division, the hope is that you can, the state can better fund the conservation causes, which are very popular, but perhaps cut back on funding and support for the environmental protection, that is clean air, clean water, toxic chemical regulation, and so forth. So I'm happy if the governor, in fact, is opposing this change. That would be a good thing, in my judgment.
I don't know that he specifically opposed it. He just didn't include it in the budget is the main point there. Yeah.
Well, if he didn't include it in the budget, that's perhaps a sign that he's not going to support it. But I guess we'll have to wait to see. As I mentioned, the Kathy Stepp, the DNR secretary, supported the plan. This apparently came from a Wisconsin state legislator who thought it would be a good idea to split it up. And it's not the first time we've heard that kind of proposal. But if you want an academic take on it, what we now have is what's called an integrated environmental agency at the state level. And that's true in well over half the states, and especially large states like New York and California. And the reason for that is there's a belief in environmental science and policy circles that it's better to bring everything together in one agency because it's all related. So, for example, water quality in a river basin affects the quality of that river, which in turn affects fisheries, which in turn affects the bay into which the water flows. If you break up fish and wildlife separate from regulating water pollution, you now have no way to integrate your management of resources. So it's better from a scientific and management perspective to have one agency where people in different departments of that agency can talk to one another and bring science and good practice to bear on the decisions. When you start breaking up the fish and wildlife part from the environmental protection, you're going to undercut the environmental protection side because decisions will not be informed by the connections between those two. And they are very strongly connected.
Well, one change that is in the governor's budget proposal says when it comes to regulating these large livestock farms, CAFOs, people call them, he wants a study. This isn't a done deal, but a study on the idea of moving regulation of water runoff from the DNR to the Agriculture Department. What kind of impact would that have?
Well, I can see the logic of it because the CAFOs, after all, are an agricultural enterprise. At the same time, it's most agriculture departments, and I think this is true of Wisconsin and most other states, tend to be pro-business or pro-farmer agricultural activities. They are generally less concerned with the harm done to groundwater underneath those lands, which in turn affects people who live close to those areas whose water is being contaminated by the CAFOs. So from my perspective, it makes more sense to have the DNR regulate surface water and groundwater quality and to take action where possible, particularly to encourage CAFOs to operate in a more sensible way that protects the quality of the water. I think that's less likely to happen if the CAFOs are not under the jurisdiction of the DNR, because agriculture departments generally are a little less vigilant in protecting something that's not immediately connected to the agricultural productivity.
Talking to Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor at UW Green Bay, looking at how the state budget might affect the state's DNR, environmental protection in the state, and state parks, Michael, a change here, the governor calling for authorizing fee increases at state parks and maybe different fee structures for camping and admission at, you know, those high-profile parks like Devil's Lake. And this comes after cuts in state support for those parks. Talk about that
a little. Yeah, well, my understanding is we didn't just cut support for the parks, we eliminated it. The parks are now wholly dependent on fees, and so far the fees are not sufficient to manage the parks. I was a little surprised when this was done 2 years ago that more people didn't take notice of it, because Wisconsin is a state that prizes the parks and trails and wants those to be maintained and available to as many people as want to get access. And generally in states where that's the case, there's a little bit you know, of what you might call a state subsidy or support. So you don't expect those who actually drive into parks to pay the full cost of maintaining the parks. You know, just like we have public schools and public university system, there's a little bit, granted a diminishing amount, but at least some state-level support. But to eliminate all state support means that you have to raise the fees significantly, and that means that people with limited income can no longer gain access to the parks, and that runs counter to the way we've done things in Wisconsin previously.
Do you know if there's much precedent to dropping state support like that? I remember at the time people were trying to find parallels or success stories, and there weren't a lot out there.
Well, I imagine not. I'm not aware of any other state that's done it, which is not to say there isn't a state that's done it. I originally hail from California, which is strongly supportive of state parks. And since I've lived in Wisconsin nearly 40 years now, Wisconsin, I thought, was comparable. We have wonderful state parks. People enjoy them, make great use of them, and there's been a lot of state support financially and otherwise for the parks. That's why I said I was surprised there wasn't more public reaction to the decision to no longer fund the state parks and make them wholly dependent upon user fees, as we call them. That is entrance fees and licensing fees. And that's okay if the fees are modest, and you could even argue, well, the people that use the parks ought to pay for them. But, you know, then you raise a question of economic inequality. Some people can't afford to pay ever-increasing fees, and they might be, they and their families might be excluded from the parks. So if we're going to continue down that road and raise fees even more, I think we're likely to see a bigger reaction as people discover that it's much more costly to visit the parks, to camp in the parks, to take their families along, and the governor may get some feedback from that that's not going to be very positive.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Scott is on the line in Green Bay. Scott, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Didn't get a chance to really write down my thoughts very long, but 3 points. I'm not sure how fees for our natural resources at the state parks and all my licenses and even possibly canoe taxes and everything else is any different than the fees they're talking about that he doesn't want to put on our highway system. I mean, it's not the bird watchers and it's not the kayakers that are paying for our natural resources, that the people from Illinois. And when we double the tourism bill every year in the state of Wisconsin and take access of our wetlands and our stuff out here in the state of Wisconsin, I think more people should be paying for those fees and taxes. And the person that you have on the radio is absolutely right. The second thing is this continuous firing of teachers, administration, and the DNR people throughout our entire state, where they only bring in younger people and they're firing all our 20-year veterans, and there's countless of them. And many of the agencies that I'm having to work with on a daily basis have shifted people annually every single year to new positions, and I could give you countless of them. But when you fire 35 or 100 scientists out of the state just so they can't bring forward evidence, I'm sorry, I go to church on Sunday, and I don't support just burying evidence so that we don't have any science to support anything. And then, like I said, he's appointed all these positions so that he has control over everything. It's authoritarian leadership. And it has to go because our resources in the state of Wisconsin are being absolutely pillaged under this conservative, and I will put it under the Christian name, that we need science, and we don't need science for Democrats or Republicans. We need science to make good decisions.
Scott, thanks for the call. I want to get into that point about cuts in staff, Michael.
Yeah, of course, this goes back to the previous biennial budget decision where a number of budget cuts were particularly targeted at scientific and educational staff in the DNR. And that was a pretty significant reduction. And that also, much as happened with the university, led to a lot of retirements or resignations. So the DNR is much weaker now in its scientific capacity. And frankly, I think that was intentional. We see a parallel at the national level where we don't want scientists to talk about climate change in the US EPA and another in the Energy Department. So Wisconsin was a bit ahead of that game. We the last time I was on this show, in fact, we talked about the efforts to eliminate discussions of climate change. And so beyond that, eliminating DNR science stats makes the agency much less capable of dealing with a whole range of issues, as Scott indicated, and that's separate from the question of fees. In other words, he notes the governor's adamant about not raising gasoline taxes to pay for highway maintenance, yet he wants to sharply increase fees for access to state resources. And as Scott indicated, that's hunting and fishing and canoeing and entrance to state parks and a whole variety of things. And I don't think we know yet just how high those fees will go. But basically, this is a defunding of the state parks and state natural resource protection.
We're talking to Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor in Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay, looking at Governor Walker's plans for the DNR after he released his proposed state budget.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of plans for the state DNR? Do you think they should be allowed to raise admission and camping fees to state parks? What do you think of moving regulation of large farms from the DNR to the Agriculture Department? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Public and Environmental Affairs at the UW-Green Bay. We're looking at Governor Walker's proposed state budget and what it means for the Department of Natural Resources.
Tell us what you think, calling 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. How do you feel about the potential changes to the DNR? What do you think of shifting some responsibilities from the DNR to the Agriculture Department? And do you have any concerns about how some of these changes will affect the environment? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers again. We've got Gordy on the line in Muskego. Gordy, hi.
How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I would love to see the DNR, and I've advocated for that for a long time, see the DNR split into two separate entities. Everyone benefits from cleaner air, water, and environmental issues. Therefore, it should be paid by all the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. Meanwhile, my belief is that the majority of fees that the DNR gets are from hunting and fishing licenses and outdoor pursuits. I'd love to see my hunting and fishing license fees go only for hunting and fishing and that related stuff. And meanwhile, then the state, you know, through the taxes and whatever else, get all the environmental stuff paid for by everybody who benefits from that feature.
Gordy, thanks for the call. So, Michael, divvy them up. Let hunting and fishing pay for that kind of hunting and fishing-related stuff, and then use general-purpose revenue for the environmental protection.
Yes, I know many people who support the splitting up of the DNR have made the kind of argument that Gordy does, and at a certain level, it certainly makes sense. People who hunt and fish say, I don't know why my fees can't go only for the activities I'm engaged in. Why do they have to go off to support the DNR? And I think if the state were willing to separately fund the DNR, that would be a reasonable thing to do. But if the state is not going to provide the funds that otherwise would be pulled out, and Gordy mentioned he's in favor of clean air and clean water too. Well, how are we going to get that if the DNR is without the resources that it needs? So you have two solutions. One, you keep the integrated approach, which I think makes sense scientifically and administratively anyway. Or if you are going to split up these functions because you think each part can better operate as a separate entity, then the state has to fund the environmental protection side. And I'm not convinced that we will do that, nor more than I'm convinced at the national level that the U.S. EPA is going to get the funding and staffing that it needs to carry out those vitally important national laws. And we already have evidence that the DNR is short-staffed and short-funded because it has been cited repeatedly by the federal EPA for not adequately protecting air and water in the state of Wisconsin and running well behind the schedule for inspections and enforcement of the law. And I think we're going to be even worse off if we don't either fund the DNR separately or continue to rely on a variety of fees for that purpose.
Gordy, thanks for the call. We're talking to Michael Kraft, expert on the environment and the politics of the environment. Back to our callers now with David on the line in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm an educator, a freelance educator. Used to work for the Audubon Society for 18 years, and I'm just so saddened by the cut of all the budget and stuff for the state parks. I mean, the state parks are for everybody, and when you put someone like Kathy Stepp, who has no experience in conservation, and you have Governor Walker, who is not educated at all, and his claim to fame with conservation is being an Eagle Scout, which is really not a lot of background. So to me, the cut of money, I don't mind raising and paying a little bit of fees, as long as the fees go to the park, which is the benefit of friends groups or whatever. But it seems to me that we need scientists, and it's a scary thing when you find out that the science is being skewed and directed, and you can't say climate change. And it's so sad to see all of these DNR. I mean, people used to, when I moved to Wisconsin in 1983, it was the theme was Escape to Wisconsin. And the idea was that we had such great parks and great places to come to. And now it's, you know, kind of a joke, Escape from Wisconsin. So that's my opinion.
David, thanks for the call. Michael, your thoughts?
Well, I think the state still has great parks, and I think people can still escape to Wisconsin. But we're in a time of political change, both within the state and nationally. And at some level, I guess political leaders think this is what the public wants. What David said, I guess I agree with pretty much. He's unhappy that we're losing scientists from the DNR, that the budgets are being cut, that, as we talked about the last time I was on, that the DNR has removed climate change from the website, and which further diminishes the role of science. So I think the solution here, I think, is that those who are listening and their friends and neighbors need to make clear their preferences to state legislators. The state legislature will act on the governor's budget and the proposals contained within it. And if state legislators hear that this is not what people want, they do not want to defund the DNR or the state parks, that they don't want to break up the DNR, I don't think the legislature will go along with this. This is not the first time we've had this kind of proposal. And I think legislators are, many of them are already skeptical. I think they need to hear from people. And you can find the contact information on the state legislature's webpage.
David, thanks for the call. We'll go next to John calling from Florence. John, hi.
Well, maybe people wouldn't be against the science if you had responsibility in an organization like NOAA that just got busted cooking numbers with regards to climate change. And maybe people could have funding for anything that you wanted if you didn't have guys running around in $70,000 4x4 pickup trucks giving tickets because your ATV license plate isn't attached the right way. This is all about choice. And if there was anybody that was calling in that wasn't getting a check from the government, from the state, or a grant to go ahead and espouse their own position, maybe we could actually have an honest discussion about this.
John, thanks for calling in. John, not wild about the enforcement arm of the DNR, for one thing there, Michael.
No, and John also errs in saying NOAA cooked the books. That's absolutely not correct. I know there's the climate denialists believe that's the case. If you read more carefully in prominent publications that have covered this, including Science, Scientific American, New York Times, Washington Post, that those scientific reports were not cooked. And it's misleading to suggest that. But I understand the larger point is that a lot of people do not trust agencies, whether it be NASA, NOAA, EPA, DNR, and so they're receptive to some kind of reorganization and budget cut. And I think that's legislators and the governor who hear from people with those views, and I think that's what motivates them to make the recommendations that we're talking about.
We'll leave it there, Michael, for now, but I'm sure this will be an ongoing conversation. Right. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That was Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Public and Environmental Affairs at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He was with us to talk about potential changes coming to the State Department of Natural Resources after Governor Walker released his two-year state budget plan this week.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.